It's been a great visit here, so thanks for the invitation. So I'm going to tell you about some recent work we had. This is with Ryan Janish, Paul Riggins, who are grad students at Berkeley, and Surjit Rajendran, who's now at Johns Hopkins. So all of us believe that there's new physics beyond the standard model. There's many hints of this, from dark matter to circumstantial evidence for inflation, quantum gravity. But it's, we're in an interesting time in fundamental physics where it's not quite clear where to look for this new physics. There's this vast landscape of energy ranges we could be looking for. But luckily, even if new physics is in the far ultraviolet, this can still lead to low energy observables. One classic example is even physics at the gut scale could be responsible for, say, destabilizing the proton. And we can go look for this in, say, proton decay experiments. And this is a very good thing to go look for. In addition, physics in the far ultraviolet can also give you new light degrees of freedom. This is quite general. You don't really need to ask for a whole lot.
And in this class of new light degrees of freedom, axions are a particularly well-motivated possibility. To get an axion, you just really need some symmetry, some new symmetry at a high scale that's spontaneously broken. You get a light Goldstone boson. This Goldstone boson can have its mass, say, from non-perturbative effects, so it's naturally very light. If it comes from high energies, it also explains maybe why we haven't seen it yet, because it talks very weakly to the visible sector. And axions are particularly interesting. They solve kind of outstanding puzzles of the standard model. Things like the strong CP problem can be solved by an axion. Dark matter, axions are great dark matter candidates. They also appear quite generically, not just from from bottom-up model building models, but from UV complete theories of quantum gravity, people here can tell you more about that. You generally expect axion-like particles to exist in a low energy spectrum. So they're a good thing to go after. By axions, I'm going to focus on basically any neutral light pseudoscalar that talks to us, that has some tiny mass, MA, and talks to us through the electromagnetic coupling. This is one of the handful of ways such an axion or an axion-like particle could talk to us through this AFF dual coupling. Here, G is just a small coupling with inverse mass dimension. So if I have such a particle in my Lagrangian, how can you go look for it? So that's the question. So the majority of axion searches using this electromagnetic coupling rely on the so-called Primakov conversion, or basically it's a coherent conversion between axions and photons in the presence of a static magnetic field. This conversion probability scales parametrically like the coupling G squared times the static magnetic field B naught squared times the your oscillation length L squared. And for typical parameters, say if G is like an inverse 10 to 11 GeV, and for say large terrestrial magnetic fields like 5 Tesla and oscillation length of 10 meters, this is a tiny probability, order 10 to the minus 19 or so. By the way, this expression holds as long as the conversion is coherent. If your momentum transfer is very large, that's no longer the case. So roughly, this holds the momentum transfer Q times the oscillation length L is less than 1. Otherwise, you're basically form factor suppressed. So this is one way to go look for axions is through this conversion. A classic type of experiment is to use the sun. The sun is a bright source of axions. And you can basically stare at the sun with a magnet. Okay, so you go into some optically shielded cavern or something. You track the sun with a, say, long dipole magnet. And you look for the axions from the sun reconverting back into KeV x-rays in the presence of your static magnetic field. And you can go look for those x-rays. The classic experiment by now is the so-called CAST experiment at CERN. They put pretty stringent constraints on this coupling G to be less than, say, inverse 10 to the 11 GeV or so. This is valid for axion masses less than an EV. Of course, you're sensitive up to a KeV because that's the energy, those are the energies of axions coming from the sun. But an electron volt is roughly when you start becoming form factor suppressed, so the sensitivity is a bit diminished. But that's sort of these are sort of the strongest constraints currently on axion electromagnetic couplings. If you're familiar with this sort of literature, you'll also know these are comparable to the sort of stellar cooling bounds based on, you know, the lifetime of observed. I think in this case, it's like helium burning stars in the horizontal branch. You get sort of similar order of magnitude constraints based on that. Those stellar cooling bounds, by the way, only require you to pay one factor of a coupling because it's an energy loss, anomalous energy loss from the star. This cast requires that you produce the axion in the sun, so you pay one factor there, and then you reconvert it, so another factor. Now, the sun is, of course, a great source of axion. These type of experiments will, you know, continue in the future with, you know, with better parameters. You can also do this in the laboratory, so these so-called light shining through walls or photon regeneration experiments. There, you basically, to leading order, replace the sun with a terrestrial source of axions, and you have sort of some terrestrial source of a large number of photons. You apply a magnetic field in the laboratory, and, you know, a few of those photons from the above expression will convert into axions. Those axions can, you know, traverse sort of the enclosure that's of the sort of the initial photon source, traverse a wall, and then reconvert and produce a tiny amount of power into some sort of a detector. So these are possible. These light through wall experiments are possible either at optical or radio frequencies. By optical, I mean, like, you know, you can use lasers. And the key point here is if you want these to be, you know, sensitive, you want to sustain large electromagnetic fields. In other words, you want a large number of photons to overcome this small probability of oscillation. You know, basically, you're overcoming a small coupling. You're paying it twice. So you want to basically use resonators in some way to build sustain large electromagnetic fields. So like I said, you can do this at either optical or radio frequencies. And here's sort of the current status of these light through walls experiments. You can use optical cavities, again, laser light, basically bouncing back and forth between two mirrors. And in the optical light through walls experiments, you have the interesting feature that the frequency of the light, roughly electron volts or so, is independent from, say, the oscillation length that you can use. You know, you're only inhibited by however long you want to set up your cavity, you know, however long you can align dipole magnets. The classic experiment for these optical light through walls is the ALPS experiment at DAISY. So this ALPS experiment at DESE, they've put a constraint which is not competitive yet with the solar axion searches. Roughly G is to less than inverse 10 to the 8 GeV for axion masses less than like a milli EV or so. But there is plans to upgrade this ALPS, you know, setup. Like I said, you need to one natural way to upgrade is to just make a longer and longer optical cavity. Of course, you know, we only have so many magnets. We can only do so well. At this point, you're not quite a tabletop experiment. The next generation wants to go to like 100 meters.
You need to upgrade it to figure out where it is, the fourth power of this.
Yeah. So, I mean.
This looks a little fantastical, right?
I mean, to go from ALPS to this projected ALPS 2, they have plans to increase the length by like a factor of 20 or so. They also want to put a really high finesse optical cavity on the receiving end, which they haven't done in ALPS 1. They also want to, you know, increase the input power by a factor of like 1,000 or so. So it's not just that that's controlling the increase in sensitivity. But yeah, so the ALPS 2, which is this projected optical experiment, should maybe constrain down to G of order, you know, inverse 10 to the 11 GeV. So by then, they hope to, you know, surpass these solar axion constraints. Okay. You don't need to do optical frequencies. You can also do RF frequencies, or also known as RF cavities. In the case of RF cavities, the key difference in the optical case is that the frequency of the photon is tied to the oscillation length because, you know, these are microwave cavities, and you're exciting them at some resonance frequency. And the resonance frequency is set by the size, you know, of order. The resonance frequencies are set by the size of the cavity. And the frequency of order gigahertz, or also like a micro electron volt or so. So they're not so well known, this experiment. Again, they're not as sensitive as this ALPS or the solar axion constraints. But there's an RF experiment that ran back in the, I think, 2013 or so called CROWS. They constrain G less than inverse 10 to the 7 GeV for all of axion masses less than, a gigahertz or a micro electron volt. This is literally a tabletop experiment because these cavities are order 10 centimeters, so corresponding to a gigahertz. to my knowledge, there's no real future expected upgrade of these type of experiments. And I'll go into this in more detail, why that is. But in this work, what we want to explore is, can you sort of do a parametrically better RF light through wall setup for axions using sort of the recent advancements in superconducting RF technology? So we have a proposal to do this, that's what the talk's going to be about. I should say that the proposal is, our goal here is to look at what are the fundamental factors influencing the sensitivity of this experiment. So basically, how well could you possibly do? What are sort of the limiting steps? We haven't yet built this. We're talking to people who are interested. But if you were to go about this, this design, what is sort of the best you can do and why? That's sort of our focus. I should say that there's also some other recent work by Khan et al., who also kind of want to utilize these superconducting RF cavities to do a parametrically better light through wall search, although it's very distinct from ours. And if you're interested, I can tell you about it more later. All right, so let's go into more details. How do these RF light through walls experiments work? So this is sort of a theorist level cartoon for my cartoon for how these sort of operate. It captures the basic features. So this is basically how CROWS, the leading order, how it conducted its experiment. So you have a production cavity and a detection microwave cavity. You apply a static magnetic field that pierces both cavities, and you put some input power into the production cavity. You drive some cavity mode, and if nature's been kind and an axion exists, it will be produced from the interaction of that static B field and the RF source. That axion will leave the confines of that production cavity, travel into a detection cavity where, in the presence of, again, the static B field, will reconvert into a photon. That photon will ring up in this detection cavity and produce a tiny amount of power in sort of an identical cavity mode. So you're looking for this tiny amount of RF power. What are the parametrics? How well can you do? Well, the signal power, of course, scales as the input power, how much power you want to input into the production cavity. You have to pay two oscillation probabilities, of course. So your signal scales as g to the fourth, static magnetic field to the fourth. And the only sort of length scale involved, like I said, is the inverse frequency here. So you go as 1 over omega to the fourth. Now you benefit, like I said, from the fact that you have resonators here, or you can ring up the fields on both ends. So you have sort of quality factors for both the production and detection cavity sitting here. And then the rest of sort of the details about how the cavities are set up, what mode you want to drive, all that all those stuff is encapsulated into some sort of dimensionless form factor. Yeah, as close as you can make, right? Right. You don't win by putting this cavity way over there and losing out on flux. All those details are buried into this form factor. Yeah.
So that's why you take it to be 0.1.
Yeah, the best they can do is order 0.1, order 1. It just depends on the modes you pick and that kind of stuff. The key point of this factor is that it's exponentially cut off when the mass is bigger than the frequency, just because at that point you have to source these axions off shell. All right. Other than that, this form factor doesn't really influence anything. All right, so this is how these light through walls experiments work with RF cavities. This is basically how CROWS operated. What about with SRF cavities? What is our motivation here? Well, our motivation is if you stare at this formula, you can see that B, I can only increase B so much. Lab-based magnetic fields can only get so large. My frequency is basically set by a gigahertz. So where's opportunity for improvement is these quality factors. Now, CROWS, and so CROWS basically used quality factors of order 10 to the 5, 10 to the 6. They're normal conducting cavities. There's recent developments in the SRF community to build cavities with quality factors of order 10 to the 10, to maybe even high as 10 to the 12. So you might think, oh, why not just do that? Well, doesn't quite work, of course, because in the setup, you're penetrating the cavities with a large static magnetic field. Superconductors and magnetic fields don't play well together. If you want to get a B field to penetrate a superconductor, there's this Meissner effect. So it's gonna expel those B fields until you reach a critical field. At what point at which point flux starts penetrating. And it's well established that, you know, at these RF, for these RF cavities, you have excessive losses once you have flux penetration. So it will severely degrade your Q, and basically what you set out to do, which is make a, which was to do this experiment with, you know, superconducting RF values for Q, didn't really work. By the way, I should say that this sort of critical field at which flux starts penetrating these SRF cavities, it's well known. It's very well measured because, you know, these cavities have application like particle accelerators. In fact, they are the accelerators for colliders. And, you know, for collider applications, we want, you know, large electric fields, right, to accelerate particles, and magnetic fields come along with them. So it's very important for that community to understand how big a magnetic field can they, so these cavities withstand. So it's a function of sort of the material you use, you know, for state-of-the-art sort of niobium cavities, it's of order 0.2 Tesla or so. But, you know, it's a rapidly developing technology. There's people who think they can maybe push this up to order 0.4, 0.5 Tesla. So
what physical size are you actually talking about?
For cavities? Tens of centimeters. Yeah, it's a gigahertz.
It's like a thin, you're using a thin on Muppet.
Yeah. In any case, so as you can see, this sort of Crow-style setup does not work if you want to make, you know, SRF cavities. If you just want to replace the RF cavities with SRF cavities. So what is the challenge that we sort of went into this saying is, can you somehow redesign this basic setup such that, you know, a large static field can exist with SRF cavities, right? And the answer is yes, it can. You know, it's not too complicated. You just need to factorize these components, right? We're using a cavity to sort of source axions, and, you know, convert axions to photons and vice versa. But why not factorize it and sort of sequester your conversion region? Have basically two cavities and a separate conversion region such that, you know, this conversion region houses a large static field that does not then penetrate your production and detection cavity. So I don't know if you learned in physics class, but if the two-body problem doesn't work, you should try the three-body problem. Any case, what are the basic elements you need if you want to use this design? Well, you can boil it down to the following. You want a production cavity that's, you know, sourcing axions free of any external static field. So you'd basically need some axion source from an SRF cavity. That's what you need on from the production side. You'd want this flux of axions to encounter a conversion region where it sees a, you know, large static field. But importantly, this static field should be isolated. It shouldn't be able to, you know, it should be confined just within this region and not, you know, penetrate the production and detection cavities, okay? Or if it does, at a minimal level, right? Less than this critical threshold. I've converted now my axions back to detectable photons, but they're existing in this conversion region. Those signal fields have to escape somehow, right? Basically, this conversion region has to be kind of special. Whatever it is that, you know, isolates this large static field must not also, therefore, isolate the signal field. It should allow the signal field to escape so I can possibly detect it. And then here I have my detection high Q cavity. I have to have some coupling to it so I can ring up and, you know, make, you know, advantage of you know, my high Q cavity. So I have to somehow ring up this detection cavity. Here are the basic elements, again, at a very cartoonish level. And we believe we have ways to accomplish all four of them. So in the production side, it's actually not so difficult, as I'll argue that, you know, to get an axion source free of any static magnetic field, you just need to excite Mohs in this production cavity that has non-identically vanishing E dot B integrated over this cavity. So, okay, this conversion region, you need to confine a large static field. You can use a fancy sort of toroidal magnet to do so, okay? How do I do what? I'll explain it. Oh. Sorry. This conversion region we envision can be like a toroidal magnet. Okay, a toroidal magnet confines static field along its tube, but not anywhere outside. Okay. Now the third condition, you know, the signal field has to escape. This toroid has to be kind of special. It has to be what we call a gap toroid. This gap toroid, I'll argue a little bit more, but it's actually inspired sort of by its related use in a recent experiment, Abracadabra, which wants to use a similar apparatus to look for dark matter axions. So this is a very different application, but of the same sort of device. Now, once the signal field escapes, it has to be able to ring up my detection SRF cavity. And we imagine, you know, one, you know, naive way to do this is sort of inductively, through like an outside pickup loop. We believe there's much better ways to do it than this. This is sort of what our benchmark of, like I said, we understand the fundamental issues with the setup. So we examine the case of a sort of an inductive pickup loop, but we're by in no means sort of saying that's the only way. Okay, so let's go through each of these steps in more detail to see.
Question about the improvement in the quality factor comes from the fact that you have less dissipated power in the solenoid.
It's a superconductor, so it's very low resistance.
Yeah. Okay.
Exactly. Low dissipation, which was that's the quality factor.
Yeah.
That's fine. Let's talk about each of these four steps in more detail. To do so, let's review some axion electrodynamics. So an axion field, like I said, talks to FF dual, also known as E dot B. And you can think of it as being sourced by E dot B. So in the limit of classical fields, once I've sourced an axion field, it modifies Maxwell's equations. Basically, derivatives of the axion field times the coupling constant interact with electromagnetic fields to source acts as like an effective source, effective charge in the case of Gauss's law, or an effective current in the case of Ampere's law. So the production from a cavity, basically you just solve the equation of motion, and you find it's just a propagator integrating over it some E dot B. And this axion field, if you just stare at this sort of modification to Ampere's law, this axion field, or its time derivative, will interact with a static magnetic field to source photons, and you can picture those photons as being what you'd expect from a effective current. In this case, the key takeaway is that the interaction with a static B field produces a sort of an effective current in the same direction as that static B field. Okay, so that direction is important. That's just sort of a way to understand what's sort of the different directionalities of what's going on. Any question? Oh. Okay. So let's talk about the axion source. So like I mentioned, you have to have a source of axions in this SRF cavity without an external B field. This is actually not so difficult to do. You basically need to excite cavity modes here such that E dot B is not identically vanishing. The key word being modes, so you can excite more than one mode, and their interaction can give you a non-vanishing E dot B. This is actually quite trivial. For instance, in a cylindrical cavity, when you have cylindrical symmetry, of course one mode won't do, but the simplest combination is something like the TE111 and TM111 modes will give you some non-vanishing E dot B. Now, the sort of the fundamental limit here is no matter how you slice it, no matter what modes you do, in fact, no matter what quality factor of this cavity is, you're basically limited by that critical field strength I mentioned earlier, which is sort of unique to these SRF cavities, which is that no matter what the input power is, no matter what the quality factor is, your E dot B, those field strengths can't be bigger than 0.2 Tesla. So
E dot B doesn't change sign, or it stays E dot B as a function of time. Doesn't change sign, or does it?
I mean, the axion field is oscillating. So
No. What he's asking is, the thing is that I have the same confusion. Is the modes? I mean, as things oscillate, or as you spatially vary, are E dot B always aligned at the same direction? Do they get in a situation where you get that? So when you integrate over the entire volume, this thing is zero?
You have to make sure you choose the right modes. Yeah, if you choose bad modes, that will happen.
So what type of modes are those?
It's actually not difficult to come up with modes that don't integrate to zero.
As E and B oscillates, does this E dot B stays the same sign, or it changes?
Yeah, you can say this. There's you pick the component, right? It will say the same sign. Yeah.
Okay.
Other problems you might have, not just the time variation, but there might be some spatial, some non, it's not going to be homogeneous, of course. So you got to make sure when you integrate over the cavity, if you integrate identically to zero, that might be trouble for you.
Yes,
now,
that's why I'm saying.
You choose the right modes, it's not going to be an issue. We showed this that there's even for a perfect cylinder, you can find modes that do this. The key point being that even if it does identically vanish when you integrate it, you're operating in sort of this near field regime. So even if it's dipolar, for instance, this E dot B that's set up, in the near field regime, you'll still see something. Yeah. Is the point. So
as long as you're still assuming that everything is as near as it is.
Yeah. Changes. Yeah. Exactly. What choice of mode you use, this and that, how what this spatial profile of the E.B looks like will factor into that dimensionless form factor. So we just showed that you could in principle still make this order 10 to the minus 2, 10 to the minus 1 or so. But the key point is, parametrically how big can it be is set by the SRF critical field.
So to jump forward again a bit from what you're saying, so VC dot B fixes to an effective B field of 0.2 Tesla, but the way you gain is you still have a B field outside that's very big, and you still keep the Q factors in the formula that you showed before.
I'm going to answer your question in one second. Exactly. So as Mino was saying, you might wonder, do you win in the axion source in this case? Because before in the RF setup, I had a large B field sitting there, large static field, 5 Tesla. 5 Tesla is bigger than 0.2 Tesla, right? And in fact, in the RF case, the RF equivalent of this sort of E dot B, you had 5 Tesla sitting there for the B field, for instance. You have some electric field from the cavity mode that was set by your input power and your quality factor. In the RF case, you can get like 10 to the 5 or so. And just so happens by numerical coincidence, sort of the effective source that you get from the Crow setup, for instance, is of order 0.2 Tesla squared for this typical parameter. So the point here is, exactly because of this critical field limit, you don't really win by using an SRF cavity in the source. You would do, in principle, just as well if you'd had a large static field with a low Q cavity, right? You don't really win because, again, this maximum value BW doesn't care about Q. It cares about what this critical threshold is, which people are hoping to improve. Again, this 0.2 Tesla is not like set in stone, but there's a lot of interest in improving that. So, the takeaway from the SRF source is the real advantage of HotQ is going to be on the detection side, just from sort of parametric coincidence, is going to be on the detection side. Okay.
That's independent of your source.
What?
That's independent of your source. You could use whatever source you wanted.
Right? For the two types of cavity sources, you might imagine. Yeah.
You have two different types of cavities: one for production, one for detection.
Yeah, you can also do that. Yeah. There's again technological issues, but just based on these parametrics, you're right. You don't win by having an SRF cavity on the production. Now, where do you win? The key sort of element in this design was this toroidal magnet, which was a conversion region. So we have a large static field that's confined in this magnet. Basically, it's generated by wrapping some current-carrying wires, some supercurrenting wires in a toroidal fashion. And just from basic E&M, that the B field follows in this sort of donut shape. So affectionately, we call this an axion donut. I might refer to it as that. So an axion comes in, interacts with the static field sitting inside the donut. And like I said, this donut has to be a bit special. It has to be sort of a gap donut in the sense that you have to confine a large static field but allow the RF signal to propagate out. So this is why we'll need a gap, as I'll show. So what's going on here? Well, by opening a gap as such, you're not leaking any of the static field outside too much, in the sense that any leakage due to this gap can be made small, as long as you make this gap small. So whatever this gap size is, that's what sets any leakage of this B naught, say, penetrating the cavities existing on either side.
But this thing cannot be superconducting. Right now, because you have this huge B field inside.
This is a superconducting magnet. They make superconducting magnets, right, with large fields.
Yeah, but how do you make sure that the leakage is good enough?
We checked, and we believe the leakage can be of order, it's been checked, that order 10 to the minus 6 of whatever's large field is sitting inside there.
10 to the minus 6?
Of that large field, yeah.
How do you make sure there's no oscillatory component?
That's one thing to check. Yeah, it's just random fluctuations and noise.
There's gonna be fluxes that are trapped. That's a huge field.
Yeah, I'm gonna talk about like trap fluxes and stuff in a second.
Yeah, okay.
But the basic cartoon is that any of this large static field that's confined is not gonna leak out to leading order. Any leakage is just parametrically suppressed by this gap size. Okay, but why is a gap actually useful? Okay, is because if you recall, the axion field is going to interact with the static B field and produce like an effective current following the direction of that B field. This effective current will produce axion-induced signal fields, what I call BA, in sort of this, if I call this B naught in the toroidal direction, this is called the poloidal direction, sort of in and out of the board. Anyway, so that's the directionality of your induced fields. And you might wonder, can I get signal inside this donut hole, or you know, outside the donut, where there's zero static, near zero static field? It's not quite as simple as that. What will actually happen is, you know, it's a superconductor. So by the Meissner effect, this BA is going to be screened due to you know, supercurrents being set up on the inner surface. This supercurrent will flow along the inner surface, and if it encounters a gap, you know, for sufficiently small frequencies, it'll encounter this gap and have nowhere to flow except outside. So this is actually the key sort of reason why such a device is being used in this dark matter experiment, abracadabra. The point being that this gap allows any internal Meissner currents to, you know, necessary to propagate outside, as long as the frequency is sufficiently small. So the so-called quasi-static frequencies in this regime. And the axion-induced current, IA, by axion-induced current, I mean what's set up on the toroidal surface as a result of the Meissner effect screening out this BA, must return sort of, you know, equal and opposite onto the outside, and also uniform. So therefore, if it returns on the outside, it can you know, propagate fields that are unaffected, okay? And that's how you'd get signal field on the outside. But what happens if, you know, you're not in a static, you know, quasi-static frequency regime? And I'll tell you what I mean by you know, sufficiently small or sufficiently large frequencies in a minute. Well, for sufficiently large frequencies, what ends up happening is that this induced current flowing on the toroidal inner surface is highly modulated spatially. It's basically oscillating back and forth. And in that case, if it's oscillating back and forth, the fields that are radiated from it are parametrically suppressed. You can think of it as almost an analogy to the fields due to some dipolar or multipolar source. They're parametrically suppressed. Turns out the suppression is not, you know, is only polynomial in what will end up being the figure of merit, but it is suppressed in this large frequency.
Can I ask you, I have the following confusion about the coupling. So you source, so the way you source the axion is like a, I mean, let's assume you have a cylinder, it's like a cylindrical spherical wave. Because you have the oscillatory dot B, and then you just produce scalar waves, not necessarily any angular momentum. Now, the axion induced here that you care about, that you convert to photons, you couple to a mode that has this very funny shape, toroidal shape.
Yeah.
So
no, I mean, the spatial profile of the axion is what it is, right?
Yes, I'm saying that in order for you to couple efficiently to this mode, so you have a spherical wave that comes in. I'm worried about the form factor here.
Yeah, you...
Because it's a funny... This is a, so you have a scalar wave, and then you want to couple to this funny-shaped mode, right? Because the mode that will induce the right current to come out is something that looks like what you've drawn there.
Yeah, okay. I think I see your question. Yeah, it's true that the axion field is you know, spatially varying already.
Yeah, and also it doesn't have this angular shape at all. Like you have something.
Yeah, you have to. You're picking out the component that follows that inner,
exactly.
And you pay some suppression there. But we worked that out. It's
so how much is
it? Yeah, what we actually did is we worked out the total effect of the axion source then interacting with the static field. So because.
Okay, that's fine. It's the same.
Because if you assume like a cylindrical cavity in the source, and this is also a cylinder, you can actually, it's not.
This is a confusing.
Yeah, you have to make sure you place it in the right way. So
yeah.
I can draw it. The design that ends up working best is if you have like, for instance, our toy calculation, you have some cylindrical cavity like this.
Oh,
like this.
I see. Okay, yeah, that makes sense. Cool.
The
yeah.
Location of the gap matter.
Locate. I mean, there's gaps like
yeah.
This. Yeah.
Does the mode change that? Because I'd imagine with this non-standard, I mean, with like a weird mode, you get a different axion field configuration.
With the non-ideal choices of modes, you're going to pay a huge form factor suppression. So that's what will affect it. Anyway.
Yeah, thank you. That makes sense.
Yeah, so there's some sort of care that needs to be taken here, because in our setup, the frequency that we're sourcing the axion is some fixed gigahertz. But we, you know, a priori, you don't know what size of the toroid to make, right? So you might wonder, you know, I want to build as large a toroidal volume as possible, right? Larger conversion volume. So you know, you don't want to make this a very tiny donut. But at some point, if this donut is sufficiently large, you run into this problem that the interaction of the axion field with the static magnetic field ultimately induces these, you know, axion-induced Meissner currents flowing. If they're going to be highly modulated at large frequencies and give you parametric suppression. So the ideal sort of sweet spot where you want to live is you want the size of the toroid, this sort of the typical radius r, let's assume it's all the dimensions of order r, to be of order the inverse frequency of your setup. So basically, everything is of order each other. All the sizes of order 10 centimeters or inverse gigahertz. You know, you don't win by going to larger and larger donut volumes because of this sort of parametric suppression of having to, you know, deal with the resulting induced current being highly, you know, high spatial gradients. Okay, so one can show that, but the key point being, you know, if you live at the sort of if you live in this sweet spot, you can expect sort of order one of the signal to propagate out. Okay, so any other questions? Okay, so what is the size of that sort of induced B field? It's of order, say, g squared. It goes as two factors of the sort of field amplitude sitting in the production cavity, one factor of the static B field. So you do win by having a large static field. And you know, plugging in some numbers, you know, say 0.2 tesla for the production cavity field amplitude. There's a form factor here I just dropped, say, that you know you can calculate in detail. Just, you know, the typical magnitude of this B field is, you know, extremely tiny, right?
Taking a form factor.
There's a form factor. I think I assume like 0.1 or so. Yeah.
0.1?
Yeah.
Okay. That's fine.
The point is this is very small, right?
Yes.
You're gonna win by, you know, resonantly coupling to this B field and you know, enhancing it in some way. So that's the whole point. You know, you'd win by this field ringing up a cavity. And the way we imagine that is, you know, the most simple way you can imagine that is inductively through a pickup loop. Pickup loop then talks to this detection cavity, and you can hope to ring it up. So, you know, the key question you can face, you know, how we want it to win, we want it to use high Q cavities, so Q hasn't shown up anywhere. Is it possible to amplify this RF signal by Q, right? That's the goal. The answer is yeah, but with a caveat. So, namely, you want to amplify this tiny induced field by, say, some large number, say 10 to the 10 or 10 to the 12. But the problem is this toroid itself is not a perfect source. Source in quotations, basically, you know, it's you know, you want to ring up fields that are being radiated from the toroidal surface. If you ring this signal field up arbitrarily, it will back react on the toroid itself, and the toroid is not perfect. It has some dissipation. It has some non-zero impedance, and you have to account for that as well. Okay, so this will show up as a non-negligible back reaction if you just, you know, think you can amplify the signal arbitrarily. So let's actually put some numbers to it. So what characterizes the impedance of this toroid? Well, there is some, you know, sort of parasitic gap capacitance or shunting capacitance. Basically, you have, you know, we're taking these internal Meissner currents to flow back onto the outside to propagate signal field out. But currents don't need to do that. They can jump these gaps sort of through a capacitance. The characteristic size of this capacitance is set by the gap thickness, or the, you know, in this case, it's going to be set by the typical thickness of superconducting wires, sort of how close can you make two wires together. So from, say, millimeter thickness wires, we expect this capacitance is fairly small, like order 10 to the minus 2 picofarad. So it ends up not being the limiting factor. Of course, this toroid, you know, say size r, just say of order tens of centimeters, has some self-inductance, right? That's what's going to be responsible for getting the signal field out to the detection cavity in the first place. But the key point being that this toroid, we imagine it's a superconducting magnet with, you know, superconducting wires. It has a non-zero and finite resistance, set by the typical, say, RF, you know, surface resistances of type 2 superconductors. As Mina was saying, there are RF, currents flowing on this toroid, right? That has a minimum resistance that's well measured, of order nano ohms or so. We actually expect it to be more because of the fact that this superconducting magnet is in this sort of mixed state where you have these vortices flowing through it. These vortices are a highly excessive source of dissipation if they're jiggled under RF fields. In the traditional expectation, you'd expect in normal magnet technology, they've worked very hard to pin these vortices so that they don't jiggle under any sort of stray RF fields. But in this case, because of sort of the fact that you have you have these sort of fringe fields exiting through the gaps and entering sort of and all sort of regions of the donut, you'd expect these vortices to be jiggling at least under an amount set by the typical fringe field you'd expect, say of order 10 to the minus 6 of the enclosed static field. So there's reason to suspect that while commercial superconducting magnet technology can achieve resistances down to 9 nanoohms, resistance here is not going to be that small. So something to consider. And so like I said, this toroid is not perfect. It has sources of dissipation. If you want to amplify the signal field arbitrarily, you'll run into a problem. The problem being that the maximum power transfer you can possibly do is ultimately fixed by when the impedance of your source, in this case like set by the toroid, is matched to the impedance of your load. Basically the pickup loop coupled to the detection cavity. This is a well-known fact in the electrical engineering community that to get a maximum power transfer, you want to impedance match your load and your source. Wasn't obvious to us, but since this is a particle physics group, you guys can appreciate the analogy that if you're scattering one ball off another, the maximum energy transfer occurs and those balls have the same mass. So it's something analogous going on here. You want to match the impedances of these objects. So it takes some, you can do some math to figure out what. So how can you, impedance match? You have an adjustable parameter here, namely the pickup loop itself. You can adjust the self-inductance of this pickup loop. Turns out this is the critical value you need is say of order Q times the resistance of the donut over the frequency. If you pick this ideal value, you'll find that the maximum power I can probably I can get in my detection cavity is of order the signal field square, signal current squared over the resistance of the donut. So it's set not by Q, but by the toroidal resistance. Right? The max power transfer in this case is you can't arbitrarily scale with Q. In this case, it's just set by the donut resistance. Now, there's a caveat here in the sense that you can't just arbitrarily make this impedance of the pickup loop whatever you want, because this SRF technology best operates at a gigahertz. And you're in adjusting self-inductance of the pickup loop, you're changing the sort of the driving frequency of the load. Then again, the natural frequency is of order gigahertz. And if you want to make sure that you don't perturb, if you don't perturb the driving frequency too far from the natural frequency, just because other complications start arising there, you'd want to make sure that this self-inductance of the pickup loop is not, it can't be arbitrarily big, or in this case, arbitrarily small. So in any case, if you want to maintain a gigahertz driving frequency, what that basically says is you may not be able to impedance match, and in which case your signal is just set by, say, Q. It goes parametrically like Q times the induced current squared. What is the takeaway here? There's an optimal signal, right? No matter how you slice it, which is that the power you'll see in your detection cavity scales like the induced current squared, and it's the minimum of these two things. Basically, either you're limited by the resistance and the losses in the donut, in which case it scales like 1 over the resistance in the donut, or it scales like Q. If you're basically depend which regime you're in depends on which dominates your losses. Okay. You could actually be in either one, depending on what the donut resistance is, or vice versa, what the cavity quality factor is. Okay. So that's the signal strength. We don't just live in a world with signal. There's also noises. So what is the noise you'd expect? The dominant source of noise is just thermal noise. And the power and noise looks like the temperature of the system over the integration time. For those of you who think about like ultralight dark matter detection, where your noise in that case often scales like 1/√ of the integration time, the reason it's just 1/integration, it actually scales better with integration time here, is because we have control over the emitting cavity, namely we have control over the frequency we're putting into it, and the we also control the mode. Yeah, because we have control of the mode, we know it's phase information. So because of that, it turns out your power and noise is your signal to noise ratio scales linearly in integration time. What is this? What is the limit to which you can cool this, or what is the limit to this temperature? Well, this system temperature is a sum of two components. It's the what actual temperature the thing is at, plus you have your sort of effective quantum temperature. Basically, there's 0-point fluctuations set by the h bar omega, for a gigahertz frequency, that's roughly 50 millikelvin. So the fundamental limiting factor here is that the system noise temperature can't be less than, say, 50 millikelvin. Otherwise, you start running into this quantum limit. Okay, so any questions? Okay. So like I said, you can either be in one of two regimes. The way we wanted to project our sensitivity, so let's take some typical values of say your production cavity field amplitude, say 0.2 tesla. Let's use a 5 tesla field inside the toroid for integration time of a year and a system temperature of say 100 millikelvin. If your resistance in the toroid is of order 100 nanoohms, which is something you might, like you said, is a reasonable estimation based on this interaction of vortices in the superconducting magnet. We've checked that 100 nanoohms seems like it's a reasonable thing. For 100 nanoohms, as long as the Q is greater than or equal to 10 to the 10, you can impedance match. You're sort of in this impedance match regime where your signal power is limited by the donut case. Okay, so as long as Q is greater than or equal to 10 to the 10, you're in that regime. And in that, for these parameters, you can perhaps do better than maybe by a factor of a few, these cast limits for solar axions, and comparable to ALPS 2, the optical limits. Now, for optimistic numbers, say if the resistance in the donut is sort of the smallest it can possibly be, sort of this fundamental RF resistance in SRF cavities, the nano ohm limit, in that case, it turns out you need Qs bigger than or equal to 10 to the 12 to be in this impedance matched donut limited power, signal power. So assuming Q is bigger than or equal to 10 to the 12, then you'll reach down to this this green line, which should definitely be comparable or exceeding the ALPS 2 projected limits. Of course,
it's
yeah, it's hard to do in this business. Yeah.
Well, one is pretty good, by the way. I mean, I just realized how small the axis is.
As Maxime was saying, you trace it down to the fact that this scales like a very large power of the coupling. So.
It's still very good. Sorry, it's just the realization just kicked in.
Those are just some projected sensitivities. Just to summarize, so what we've done is, we proposed a new design for an axion search based on, SRF cavities. Our particular realization involves this sort of gap donut for a conversion region. And like I mentioned, one has to be careful about, back reaction onto this donut and its source of dissipations, as well as, signal screening that sets sort of the optimal size you want to make this donut. So we consider these fundamental factors. We've also considered, like Mina was saying, sort of the form factor that involved, although I didn't really talk about it too much here. Bottom line, we think this is comparable and complementary to the future optical searches.
Thank you. Can you say about the Anson proposal?
Yeah, sure. So what they have in mind is something quite distinct, although it has, at least to my understanding, its own challenges. So they don't have like, you know, cavity, toroid cavity. They just have one cavity. They have one cavity. They input.
Oh, yes, I know which one you're talking about. Yeah, forget about that. That's much better.
Well, here, you know, I'll be honest, you know, because we're on video. The one thing I did not talk about, which is a major engineering challenge here, although this engineering challenge would exist even if like you didn't do an axion search. If you just tried to do like a hidden photon search using SRF cavities, the problem, you know, as you can tell, the quality factor here is like 10 to the 10, 10 to the 10. You need to match these guys to within a part in 10 to the 10, right? You want to, you know, random, you know, frequency drifts, fluctuations, whatnot, will cause this guy to drift, you know, from its resonance frequency that you, you know, and this basically has to be some feedback loop maintaining this precision.
I'm not sure that's this. I mean, one part of the rules are about frequency.
Well, it's a challenge that they're working on. Like I said, it's the case whether you want to do this in an axion search or hidden photon search. So, you know, that's the technical challenge here. That's yet to be overcome, but it's actively being worked on. It's nothing fundamental.
Do you really have to have the first cavity superconducting?
Yeah, you're saying why can't I make this an RF cavity and with a large B field?
Yeah, because
I think you can actually. We wanted to look at the case where this is superconducting, but you can.
The last one, yes, because then you gain in the.
I think you can.
Given that you don't source much.
I think if you can find some way to make this, you know, with a large B field, isolated from here, then yeah, I see in principle no reason.
No, I was thinking the opposite. Actually, the first one would be not very, because you're.
This is the source.
Oh, you put the source
there.
Okay, so I was thinking the source on the other side.
Yeah, so in principle, yeah, I think you can do this. Again, you just need to make sure, you know, isolate this B field, you kind of.
Yeah.
So like in that case, like, do you essentially need like some better quality factor radio wave to put into the cavity?
What do you mean?
So like, the thing that I'm not quite understanding is like, when you say like your noise go down as an integration time as linearly, right?
Yeah.
That is only when like I think like the source cavity has the same quality factor.
Yeah, I mean,
it has to be very narrow. Like, so
of course, I mean, it has to be narrow. To do this experiment to begin with, it has to be narrow because you're coupling to the specific mode. Otherwise, you'll never ring this up by a factor of Q, right?
Right.
You're, so, you know, a part in 10 to the 10 from being, you know, one part in 10 to the 10 away from being a Q enhanced to being not Q enhanced. So.
When you have a gigahertz, you have a gigahertz wave, right?
Yeah.
So if you have 10 to the 12 Q, right? Like this means like your, doesn't that what necessarily mean like your width is something like millihertz?
Where are you getting that from?
Gigahertz over 10 to the 12.
Do you understand?
And then like you are talking about like iteration time of a year. And then the noise scaling down as 1/T all the way to 1 year.
Yeah, that's true.
In the last projection. Is there like a contradiction here?
No.
Why not?
Because I think you can do this. They do this in cantilever experiments too.
The second part of the time dependence, I think, is 1/2. Once you go beyond like the.
I don't think that's the case. We can look it up later.
Yeah.
I don't think that's a problem. As long as you have phase information, I don't think that's a problem. Because this is what you do now. You source, you have, it's not like a dark matter search. That's a key point here.
Yeah, but like you need, like the precision, you know your phase information is 1/10 to the 12.
Well, there is a tricky part. Let's discuss this afterwards.
Okay.
So go get coffee and discuss it. I'm not sure this is correct. For example, in cantilever experiments, I can tell you they do this regularly, right? The Q factor that they have there, they have, let's say kilohertz frequencies, and the Q factor is 10 to the 5.
Yeah.
They still integrate coherently for 10 to the 7 seconds.
But then you have phase change.
What do you mean the 5? No, it does not. I thought they still integrate coherently over 10 to the 7.
That's not what I remember, but you can show me.
No, you don't just integrate, no. You cannot just integrate coherently for 1/Q. That's the bottom line.
There is some intrinsic bandwidth, although we're assuming that you know that in input better than I think what you're saying.
As long as you have good phase information, I don't think that's a problem.
Like for the dark matter case, you have there's some finite width that we just don't know, right? Beyond. Here, because you're
worse, but like here, I saw it's like okay.
Yeah, let's discuss.
Fun question. I mean, do you have to optimize the geometry of the other torus radius? So you talked about the outer radius, but is there anything to be said for maximizing the volume versus?
We thought about this, and ultimately, it's the simple answer is this has to be of order 10 centimeters. Set by,
You just want it also to match the width.
You want like a skinny tube and like a big thing or something like that.
I don't know. I just was wondering.
Yeah, this ended up being the best, I think, for like form factor reasons. But you're talking about Anson's proposal.
Yeah, I now remember which one that was.
What is Anson's
proposal? So for those guys who don't know, so Anson, Yoni Khan and company have so very different from this. Here we have source. It's very similar to a light through walls because you have source detector, but you just put we factorize the convergent region away from either of these guys. In Anson's case, they input a large amount of power here into a few modes, and the axion coupling will mix those modes and produce a tiny amount of power in a different one.
Only
for what?
Specific mass, no?
Or specific mass? I mean, these are all mass shouldn't matter here. It's
Here.
It's
like the F to the 4 coupling. Yeah. You put it in true mode.
Okay. Yeah.
It's not resonant.
They want to build it such that it looks resonant. Like you can get like a true mode frequency to add up to another.
Exactly, yeah.
That's where the resonance is. But like,
that,
I don't think
the
you can maintain
frequency, does it match to any of those?
I think like they can find like some of the modes, like by designing a shape, such that there are three modes whose frequency is like one equals the sum of the other. Mm-hmm. But like, there's no way like you can maintain like all three modes to the same quality factor.
Yeah. I mean, that's a problem.
That sounds
really
hard.
Maybe a cool way of saying that is, they're dumping a lot of power into their initial modes and reading out a tiny amount of power in a different mode.
Yeah.
Things are nonlinear. Why doesn't it just randomly, get some...
It's different from what Slack people are working on.
I think
so. Slack people are doing what again?
Standard 2.
I think, also they put some power in one mode. I don't think the paper is out, but I have forgot the exact details.
Slack?
They have these two cavities, right?
Slack.
They're doing like millicharge particles?
They also have a project from Max.
Oh, we can talk about that later. I'm not too familiar with it.
I don't know about that either.
I think like they are doing like a millicharge, and the idea is like
they have two projects. One is axions, that's for sure.
Yeah, it's news to me, so we can maybe talk about that later.
Maybe it's the same as the Fermi Lab one, but that's like a two cavity setup, which is basically a nice rule.
Yeah, I wouldn't really call Anson's like a light through wall setup. It doesn't really function this in the same sort of way. Parametrically, it's very different, but it uses an SRF cavity. It has its own challenges,
What are the other advantages in this kind of approach?
Like I said, the key challenge here is, large amount of power, and you're reading out a tiny amount of power in a different one. So how do you know things don't just...
But do you gain in some other aspect? Or?
It wasn't clear. I think if I remember the plots, it happened to do roughly similar to what we were doing, although the parametrics are kind of different. They don't scale the same way in like Q. Again, what was really surprising and what we found was, not really meaning to, but we wanted to get our sensitivity to scale with Q, but because of this conversion region and its losses, you can't do better than a certain amount. So it really is set by the donut and its sort of resistance in a sense. So suppose someone came to you, I like the joke. Suppose someone came to you with a cavity, a quality factor of 10 to the 14 or some really high number, And they wanted, of course, to do fundamental physics with it. They come to you and say, you know, how can you do an axion search of this? Well, if you look at our setup, it's not going to help you if you're 10 to the 14, right? You're limited by the donut. Yeah. So that was the limitation we ran into. Although it, you know, still do pretty well.
Just a naive question. What drives the, what the technological applications drive the R&D on the superconducting?
Oh, accelerators is one?
It's all by product of accelerators.
The Fermilab group, I know.
Do you need like this gigantic Q factors for accelerators?
You just want a large electric field.
Right, okay.
I think the best way they've, the most efficient way they have of doing this is aligning their particle collider with SSRF cavities.
There's a lot of medical application, and you want to save energy. Low dissipation.
Is it obvious that you can shield your production cavity enough?
Well, yeah, we didn't think about this too much, but in print, yeah, I think it's
like any tiny amount of leakage means that you can measure that.
You need to be very careful about this P not leaking out. I mean, in principle. And how much it varies at those frequencies. I mean, 10 months, 26 Tesla, I mean, it's a tiny field. I mean, no one has demonstrated such level of sensitivity, even after long integration times. I mean, you would require a year is like 10 to the 7 seconds. So you need a fundamental sensitivity of a magnetic 10 minus 21 Tesla per root hertz or something.
No, but that's different, right? You're not...
I mean, if I'm telling you, if I were to convert, if I want to pick up this, no one has measured such a small magnetic.
Yet, I mean.
Even ADMX is not measured that small, right?
But the point is, you're letting this accumulate in a cavity and ringing it up. So.
Still, there is all sorts of noise. It's not just when you ring up the this signal, you also ring up the noise.
Yeah. I know.
That's all I'm saying. It's just.
That's encapsulated in this sort of, you know, you want. To answer your question, we didn't think too much about shielding. Yeah, that's one thing. It's in principle doable, right? It's just a question of. Yeah.
I don't know what's up to do about 10 minus 26 Tesla level.
No, he's talking about shielding the static field.
Yeah, but the static field. Well, yeah, you don't really care so much, too, right? The static, you care about how much it varies at those.
No, like
even your source is producing waves at that frequency.
You're talking about the signal field then?
Yes, yeah. I mean, even if you have some tiny amount of linkage from there, you need to be extremely careful. Because it's exactly the frequency that you're trying to measure.
Yeah. We didn't think about that too much. Although, in talking to experimentalists, you know, they were more concerned about, you know, in the setup, the fact that, you know, we want the effective Q of this pickup and cavity. And we use the pickup, but this effective Q of this load here, you want it to be 10 to the 10 or 10 to the 12 or whatever. You know, it's very hard to just get, you know, a very low dissipation pickup loop and with this coupling. That was the key, the hold up there. So, we haven't come up with the best way of doing that. You know, although I understand the fundamental factors, you know, the sensitivity, you can use a pickup loop to model it. Although in talking to experimentalists, that was the biggest sort of hurdle. Yeah. Because this, you know, just taking this setup on face value, this pickup will come with all sorts of dissipation. You know, your effective Q is never going to be anywhere close to 10 to the 10, is the claim. You know.
How much do they say is doable?
How much is doable?
Yeah, what would they say? Okay, what did they say that it's reachable?
Let's just say that you know, if we're only gaining by the Q on the detection side, that's the. You know, 10 to the 10 or 12 is right now, you know, hard to imagine with this type of setup.
Yeah, but what is doable right now?
I'm not too sure about that. Yeah.
Okay. So they didn't give you a number.
No.
You said it, but I missed it. The toroidal geometry for the commercial cavity, it's motivated by the fact that you can allow a very constant V-naught field, or which is an idea that you had and you tried.
Yeah, it's not like fundamental, like you kind of just, you know, you can imagine why doesn't the solenoid work? That's, you know, a toroid is the most compact way, and it's, you know, it illustrates the basic requirements.
That's a good idea. Thank you again.
Yeah.